This program does not create an attorney-client relationship between Moss and Barnett, a professional association, or any attorney appearing on this program and any caller or listener. Please remember that we can only give general information, and every case is unique. Always check with your individual attorney for any specific legal concerns. If you are in need of specific legal advice or are looking for an attorney, please do not hesitate to give Moss and Barnett a call at 612-877-5000.
This is WCCO's Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett.
Thanks so much for joining us on a gorgeous summer day. Tom Schroyer is in studio. Dave Beek is back. We've got a great show lined up. We've got to, before the summer's out, take this show on the road.
Well, I'd say so, Steve, although, you know, maybe you won too many road closings this year for that.
Yeah, there you go.
Anyhow, yeah, it is great to be here, and I'm looking forward to today's program with Dave Beek, who is now back for, I don't know, his fourth or fifth visit to our show.
I guess I just must not be living a clean life. I keep coming back for prison.
Well, like a bad penny, I guess. Okay. Anyway, Dave, welcome to the show. It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
Dave Beek is a senior shareholder with Moss & Barnett. We are a 70-lawyer business law firm and integral to our practice and really, in fact, quite a focal point for our legal practice now is intellectual property. And, Dave, you're a member, a senior member of our intellectual property group, which covers really all aspects of IP.
That's right. We do patents, trademarks, trade secrets, copyrights. It keeps us very busy, and we like to think that we help our clients really derive more value from their businesses.
And who'd have thought it was merely it was actually less than 10 years ago, and we didn't even have a single patent or IP lawyer on our team.
Well, I think it's a reflection of our clients and the evolution of their businesses and the importance that they place in protecting the intellectual property, and frequently that means inventions and that means patents.
Now, you've been practicing patent law for 23 years.
Correct.
And to be a patent lawyer, you have to be admitted to the practice of the patent bar before the United States Patent and Trademark Office, if I'm understanding it.
That's right. That's right. Patent law and admiralty law are the only two specialties that require separate bar admissions.
And in that connection, that is being a patent lawyer, what exactly do you do?
Well, I'm very blessed to have a very varied practice. I spend time writing patents and getting patent grants for my clients to protect their inventions. I provide a lot of opinions, legal opinions, to clients on whether or not they're infringing someone else's patents, since, of course, they want to avoid that. I handle a lot of transactional matters where they may be trying to license their patents out to others for money, or they're trying to obtain licenses from someone else for a patent that they really need a right to practice. And I also practice litigation.
I understand that you've been working on a number of foreign patents as well.
Well, that's right. You know, it's a whole big world out there, and a lot of times businesses, the markets for their products aren't confined to the United States, and a U.S. patent only works in the United States. So if you want to prevent others from practicing your invention in Canada, for instance, well, you've got to get a patent issued in Canada or a European country, for instance. And so when you file a patent application, the U.S. may be just the start. That may be the top of the pyramid, and then depending upon how far geographically you want to protect it, your base gets larger and larger.
I must say I've had a lot of fun working with you on a litigation involving a patent for a piece of jewelry that has application throughout the world and has involved international legal issues.
Well, that's right. And, you know, who would have thought that you could get a patent for an item of jewelry? But really, it's a mechanical device just like anything else, albeit a much more attractive-looking mechanical device. And in this case, the patent covers a particular way of confining the travel of a jewelry item along the strand. And that's what the whole litigation is about.
I know you were telling me earlier in the week, too, that you've been wrestling with the Chinese patent office and having to pick up some Mandarin on the run.
Well, that's right. Fortunately, I've got translators who are a little more skilled in Mandarin translations than I am. But, yes, not every country out there speaks and writes in English. And so when we're dealing with the Chinese patent office, everything comes to us in Chinese.
In your prior visits with us, we've talked about many, many aspects of patent law. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the ways in which patents have been misused and how that happens and what the ramifications are, as well as some of the other items in the news of the patent bar here these days. Very interesting and, I might add, quite important stuff, especially for really almost any business owner, even if they don't have a patent portfolio.
Well, that's correct. You know, the business or the individual has gone through a lot of work and expense to get the patent issued to them. Well, their work doesn't end now. They've got this wonderful asset that gives them the right to exclude others from making, using, selling the invention, but they've got to use it in a responsible manner. And really, for patents, everything always comes back to what we call the claims.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because I think people, unless they're familiar, very familiar with how a patent works, might be a little confused or in the dark, rather, about how a patent actually works, what it looks like and what it does.
Well, there's really two parts to a patent. There's the first part, which is the
First of all, let's maybe just very basic level. It is actually a document issued by the patent office.
Well, that's right. It's a document that's issued by the patent office, and the purpose is to describe in writing the invention so that other people can practice it without undue experimentation once the patent expires 20 years later. And then it is also meant to define, much like a surveyor might define the boundaries of a piece of real estate property, what is the scope of the protected invention. And that's what we call claims. And that's really, really important, because these claims that define the invention are what were considered by the patent office in deciding whether or not to grant the patent, but just as importantly, they're what other people should be able to rely upon to make sure that they're not infringing the patent once it issues. And so really, there's this notion of fundamental fairness, that a patent document should be very specific and it should be very clear about what is being protected and therefore what other people have to honor.
So once a patent's been granted, is there anything more that a patent owner needs to do in order to assert his or her rights in the invention, or is that just enough to make the royalty money flow in?
Well, would that it was that easy. There's a couple things you're going to need to do. First of all, there are going to be three times during the life of the patent where you have to pay what's called a maintenance fee, and that is just to keep the patent in good standing, good order. It's a way of culling out the patents that the patent owner has lost interest in over time because he doesn't pay the maintenance fee. The second issue is that the patent owner is going to need to mark his product, the product or a label that's associated with it, with the patent number. Now, this is the way of telling other people, providing them fair warning that a patent exists that covers that product, and then what the scope of the patents is. It would have a number. People can go to the patent office website. They can look up the patent number, and they can see those claims I just talked about before.
So people can actually go to the USPTO or patent office website. Can they read the patents, all of them?
They can. They're all electronically available. I believe all going back to the very first patent that issued in 1792 for a potash product signed by George Washington himself.
Well, that'd be fun to see.
That would be fascinating to go read some of that.
And by the way, the first examiner of the patent office was Thomas Jefferson.
Well, and he was quite an inventor himself. How many patents did he earn?
You know, I don't know if he earned any, but he was smarter than everybody else, so that counted for a lot.
And plus, he was president a few terms.
Yes.
All right, we have much more on the way. Dave Beek is in studio. Tom Schroyer is our host. Mark these words. We've got a whole lot more on this topic coming up. And if you have a question as well about patents and how it works, Dave Beek's an expert on this topic. We certainly invite your calls. The phone number on the program, 651-989-9226. Toll free, 1-866-989-9226. By the way, you can text the program as well. The text line, 81807, that's 81807, and that's powered by Home Service Plus, an offering of CenterPoint Energy. Here on News Radio, 830 WCCO.
This is Sidebar on Minnesota Law.
You can't handle the truth.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
Are you sure this is legal?
You think you know every trick in the book, and they come up with another one.
Did you know Moss and Barnett attorney Clifford A. Taney Jr. went on to fame while serving during World War II as general counsel to the super-secret nuclear development program of the U.S. Army, known as the Manhattan Project?
Minnesota Law is presented by Moss and Barnett and returns in a moment on News Radio 830 WCCO.
The news you depend on from the WCCO news team is available right now at WCCORadio.com.
It is 1222 Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett, available online at moss-barnett.com. Tom Schroyer is our host. Dave Beek back in studio again. Mark these words. We're talking patents. By the way, if you have a question about patents, feel free to call the program today. 651-989-9226, toll free, 1-866-989-9226. By the way, Texas studio as well, 81807, that's 81807, powered by Home Service Plus, an offering of Center Point Energy. And you were talking before the break about markings. I've seen patent numbers, and I'm sure people have seen patent or U.S. patent number, but they've also seen the term patent pending. And I've seen that a fair amount on products. Is that fair warning as well, that, hey, we're in the works, we're trying to get this?
Well, that's right, Steve, and that's exactly what patent pending is meant to do. The moment you file a patent application, then under the law you're entitled to write patent pending on your product or your literature, which is a way of warning other people that you've got protection in the works. You don't have your patent yet, so they don't know for sure what your claims are going to look like. But they better tread carefully, because if they put a lot of money and time into marketing their product, well, if you get your patent issued, they may have to cease and desist in the marketplace. And that's one of the most valuable things that a person can get in filing the application.
Well, but that could be really quite an occasion for some abuse, it would seem to me, if somebody was either filing a bogus patent claim and just putting patent pending on all of their products, or even just filing or putting patent pending on without having an application on record.
Well, you know, there is a there's an ethical and a legal responsibility that the application and the claims have to bear some relationship to the product, that they have to at least in good faith be valid, because you're right. Otherwise, people could just file a crayon drawing with the patent office, put patent pending down, and they would have no hope or prayer of ever getting meaningful patent protection. So I shouldn't have been quite so glib in the way I responded to that. But as long as you're proceeding in good faith, you don't have to have 100% guarantee that you're ultimately going to have your patent issued, because, you know, what in life has 100% guarantee? But you're on your road.
Well, and along the same lines, if somebody sees the patent pending stamp on a product, they know that a patent application is pending. But is there any place they can go to see what the invention, how the invention is described, or what its scope is?
Well, increasingly they can. The United States Patent Office, about 5 or 6 years ago, went to a publication system where, in general, applications will be published and therefore publicly available online at the Patent Office 18 months after the filing date. Now, there is a caveat. If the applicant has no plans to file for patent protection, we talked before about you could get patents issued in foreign countries, you can then file what's called a do not publish request at the time you file your U.S. application. And if you do that, then the patent office in the U.S. will not publish your application. Now, that can be valuable, to your point, to the applicant, because it keeps the competition guessing exactly what form their claims are taking, what form their claims may ultimately take, and it maybe provides them just a little bit more breathing space in the marketplace before their competition would come in and try to copy their product.
Now, is it useful to mark patent after the patent's been issued as well?
Well, it's not only useful, but it's actually required by the law if you want to recover damages from an infringer. So really, you know, we certainly advise all of our clients once the patent issues to put patent and the patent number on the product because that then fulfills all the requirements of the marking statute. It provides the fair warning that I talked about before to competitors and others in the marketplace. They can go, they can look up the patent number, they can see the claims, they can satisfy themselves where the boundaries of the protection are, and so therefore where they can properly proceed outside of those boundaries. It also provides them the ability to go out and try to look for what we call prior art to invalidate that patent. You know, there are patents that do get issued from time to time that aren't valid because maybe there was some prior art, other people's patents, other people's scientific journal articles, other things that were done commercially in the marketplace that the patent office and maybe the patent owner didn't know about. So it's very much a dynamic process once the patent issues, but these are all valuable rights.
We have a whole lot more coming up on the program. Tom Schroyer is our host. Dave Beek is in studio on the topic of mark these words, legally required markings of patent numbers on products can produce unexpected legal liabilities for patent owners as products change or patents expire. And we'll have much more on the topic. If you have a question about patents, feel free to call the program, 651-989-9226, toll free, 1-866-989-9226. It is Minnesota Law, each and every Saturday between noon and 1 o'clock, here on News Radio, 830-WCCO.
From the Buick Studios, this is News Radio, 830-WCCO.
Welcome back. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett, each and every Saturday between noon and 1 o'clock. Tom Schroyer is our host in studio. Dave Beek is back. Mark these words. We're talking patent law again, and if you have a question, feel free to call Dave and Tom today on the program, 651-989-9226, toll-free, 1-866-989-9226. Our text line is always open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 81807. That's 81807, powered by Home Service Plus, an offering of CenterPoint Energy.
Our topic today is marking of patents, and we were just talking about the need of an owner of a newly issued patent, Dave Beek, to make sure that they mark the patent, or the product rather, as patented. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they can't collect damages for infringement.
That's correct.
But what happens if somebody has been issued a patent on something that they're not making the product on? How do they protect themselves in that situation?
Well, the marking requirement only applies to products that you're actually selling. So if the patent owner isn't selling a product, then there's nothing to mark. Now, they will still have patent rights. They can certainly sell or license those rights to others to use.
But they can't collect damages if there's been infringement in that situation, from what I understand it.
Well, no. They could collect damages because since they had no product that they themselves were selling, then there was nothing for them to mark, so therefore they didn't offend the statute by not marking, and so therefore there'd be nothing to keep them from collecting damages.
Okay, so that's a little bit tricky.
Yes, there are some tricky things in patent law.
Well, it sounds like more than a few tricky things, yeah. So, okay, so now we have a situation where somebody is putting a patent label on a product, but they don't actually have a patent. I understand that's become quite a controversial topic in the patent bar.
Well, it has, and not really so much that they don't have a patent, because there the liability would just be absolutely clear cut. If you are representing that you have a patent that has issued and you in fact never had a patent issue, or maybe you never even applied for one, then the ground for frauds is just absolutely clear, and you're going to be liable. But let's shift the discussion a little bit and say maybe you had a patent that issued. It was in force for 20 years, but it expired, because patents don't last forever. Maybe you have a product that was covered by a series or is covered by three or four patents, and three of them are good and only one of them is expired. Maybe you've got a product that you improved over time to the point where it now no longer is covered by the claims. In all of those cases, you're going to have what's called an unpatented product. And there's another statute that creates liability if for fraudulent patent mismarking, if you put a patent marking on a product that is unpatented with an intent to deceive. And the point here, obviously, is to not chill competition by allowing patent owners to misrepresent that they have a patent in force when they don't, or they have a patent that's no longer covering their product. Now, this was a very sleepy issue for years and years because the courts had interpreted that this $500 penalty just applied to the decision by the company to mismark. And no one was going to file a lawsuit for $500. But then the court said, well, no, it really applies per incident of mismarking. So, for instance, there was a case filed a couple of years against Solo Cup. They're who make all the drinking cups that we all use, who had two patent numbers that had been marked on the lids of their drinking cups that had expired. They hadn't removed those patent numbers from their cups in time. And an enterprising patent attorney who knew the system filed a lawsuit against Solo Cup for mismarking, asking for $500 for each of those lids that was sold. Well, they had sold, you know, billions of lids, which now meant you were talking about potentially hundreds of billions of dollars of penalties. And under the law, the patent attorney, as the person who was the plaintiff bringing the suit, was going to be able to keep 50% of that money.
I remember those.
Would go to the government.
I remember those lids. They were at every McDonald's, Burger King, fast food restaurant in town, gas station. And Steve, do you remember seeing the patent numbering on those?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. And this is particularly a problem for a lot of products that are cast or they're blow molded, because the patent number will typically be put in the molds. And so, you know, the patent owner obviously doesn't want to go through the expense of just getting entirely new molds the moment the patent expires. And so you have this problem, or you have had this problem, where these expired numbers just kind of stay out there for a period of time on these products. And all of a sudden, everybody's attention got drawn when these suits were filed. There was another suit that was filed a couple of years against Brooks Brothers.
Well, let's get to that suit in a moment. But when was it that the courts first took the position that the penalty for falsely labeling a product as patented was $500, not per act in general, but rather for each specific product? In this case, we're talking about these cup lids, where I must tell you, when my sons were growing up, I'll bet we were going through 10 of those a weekend, for heaven's sake. That's a lot of money to pay at $500 a clip.
Well, that's right. And that particular case, I think, was about that was issued about 4 years ago. So it's a relatively recent issue. It all of a sudden changed it from being a sleepy little academic esoteric issue to a very real-life issue that could cost lots and lots of money for patent owners.
I'm going to guess that where money is to be found, lawyers are close behind filing lawsuits. Is that true in this case?
Well, it seems to have been, and I might say it wasn't every patent attorney, but it was a group of them. And, for instance, in the first quarter of 2010, 132 federal lawsuits were filed for patent mismarking. These were all against companies that everybody would know, Gillette, 3M, Bayer Health. You know, these are all good, reputable companies out there. Their problem was they had some expired patent numbers on their product.
Now, with the Solo Cup example, $500 per cup lid doesn't seem even reasonable. What's the remedy here? What's going to happen?
Well, fortunately for Solo, the case has gotten ultimately decided in their favor on appeal. But you can imagine they had some sleepless nights along the way.
What was the decision? How did the decision turn out in favor of Solo, Dave?
Well, because go back to what I said a few minutes ago about the statute. The statute says there's liability if you mismark an unpatented product with intent to deceive. And so the initial focus was on the unpatented. Now, their patents had expired, and so the lower court said, well, that is unpatented. It doesn't matter that you actually had a valid patent for 20 years. You don't now. And so the court in the Solo case and the court in the Brooks Brothers case that I also mentioned got into kind of these esoteric arguments then about whether anybody had really been harmed. You know, had the government, for instance, really been harmed by having someone leaving an expired patent number? Had competition really been chilled? These patent attorneys, these people who were bringing these kinds of suits, had a lot of speculation about chilling of competition in the marketplace, but nothing that was too hard and too secure. And so the appeals court just last month put the attention back on the intent to deceive part of it, which is probably where it really properly should have been in the first place. And they said, was there an expired patent number left in the drinking cups? Yes. But was there intent to deceive? Well, while Solo may have known that the patent number had expired, which, you know, created at least an initial suspicion that there was intent to deceive, that the fact that they relied upon advice from their own attorneys that it was reasonable for them to wait until the next time they needed to change their molds and therefore just eliminate those patent numbers from their molds, that was reasonable, and therefore that rebutted the initial presumption that there had been an intent to deceive. So they dodged a very, very large damage number. But, you know, I think the takeaway for all the patent owners out there is you never really know what judge you're going to draw in the case. You never really know whether your judge is going to think that what you did was reasonable. And so you're better off just making sure that you keep an eye on your patents. You know when they're going to expire. You take reasonable action within a reasonable time period to remove patent numbers as they expire or remove patent numbers as your product evolves outside of those claims. You know, what do they say? An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
And I, as I understand it, the same principles apply here in this Brooks Brothers case involving the use of an antiquated device to tie bow ties on.
Well, that's right. And I hope you aren't saying bow ties are antiquated, but the device was antiquated. But, yeah, in the case of Brooks Brothers, it was something called an Adjust-A-Lox, which is that little metal clip. For any men who've worn bow ties, they'll know what this is. It allows the length of the bow tie to be lengthened or shortened. And there was a label on these bow ties that said the original Adjust-A-Lox bow tie, and it gave a couple patent numbers that were in the 2 million range. Now, Tom, we're in the 7,500,000 range right now. So anybody should have known these were very, very old, where they expired most certainly. And the plaintiff in that case asked for $500 for every single one of these bow ties that had been sold. And, you know, that case is going to probably get dismissed for kind of the same sort of grounds. I think Brooks Brothers argued, well, this was really more historic fun leaving this thing on. The patents had been expired for 50 years. It more emphasized the historic and long-lasting nature.
All right, we have more on the way. By the way, go to the phones in a moment. We have a quick break. Tom Schroyer is our host. Dave Beek, mark these words, patent law on the spotlight again today here on Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett on News Radio 830 WCCO.
This is Sidebar on Minnesota Law.
You can't handle the truth.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
Are you sure this is legal?
You think you know every trick in the book, and they come up with another one.
Did you know a team of Moss and Barnett attorneys worked on the appeal of the case that served as the basis for the motion picture, North Country?
Minnesota Law is presented by Moss and Barnett and returns in a moment on News Radio 830 WCCO.
WCCO, now available crystal clear on 102.9 WLTE, HD2, Minneapolis, St. Paul.
Welcome back. It is Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett. Phone number on the program, 651-989-9226. Toll free, 1-866-989-9226. Text the studio anytime, 81807. Powered by Home Service Plus, an offering of CenterPoint Energy. To the phones we go. We've got Gordy in Apple Valley. Gordy, you're on the air with Dave Beek and Tom Schroyer. Hello.
Hello, guys. How are you today?
Hello, Gordy.
Just have a quick question. We have invented a product. We're in the middle right now of doing the initial search and everything before we apply for patent. And we have found that this is in the safety field. We have found that there's two products that were patented back in 2003 and 2005, respectively. And we did some research on these products and have found that they have never been manufactured. So now I know the FTC did something against people hoarding domain names and never using them and holding companies hostage to resell the domain name. Has that been true of the patent courts as far as somebody just putting a patent or creating a patent and not doing anything with it?
Gordy, that's a great question. Unfortunately for you, patents is different from trademarks. Because trademark's all about protecting the consumer, and because there's, in theory, a limited number of words or symbols or whatnot that can be used to identify source of origin of the products, if you don't use it, then you lose your right to that trademark registration. Patents, on the other hand, are about protecting inventions and giving incentives to people to invent. And so there's no requirement once you get the patent that you actually have to manufacture and sell a product. I mean, for instance, there's a lot of small inventors out there that just may simply not have the capitalization and the support and whatnot to be able to actually form a company to make and sell a product and, you know, all the insurance and all the rest of it. Now, I think it might be worthwhile if you think one or both of these patents actually provides a roadblock to you moving your product ahead, call them up. See, you know, you should be able to trace them through the patent itself. See if they might be interested in giving you a license so that you would then have permission to proceed with your product without worry of suit. That would represent some money going to them. And they might be delighted with that solution, and it certainly would be a lot cheaper than plowing ahead and risking a lawsuit, which can be much more expensive to defend.
And I assume from Gordy's call, from his question, that he doesn't have any opportunity to design around the earlier patents, but that would also be a potential way to avoid those.
That's right, Tom. We talked about claims early in the program. The claims, just like a surveyor defines the boundary of the property. The claims are the boundary of the protected invention. So, Gordy, if you could figure out a way with your product to leave out, to omit, at least one of those required elements in a claim, well, in this case, each of the claims, then you don't have to worry about infringing. And I mentioned one of the things I do, and most patent attorneys do, is to help advise clients on whether or not they infringe someone's patent. So it might be worth it for you to, if you haven't already, to talk to a patent attorney. Maybe there's a way that you aren't infringing anyway and you just don't have to worry about these patents.
Dave, let me circle back, though, to some concept that I think was inherent in Gordy's question, and that is he mentioned that his invention was in the realm of safety. And that these patents were sitting on the shelf, not being used. And I'm sitting here thinking, you know, what if somebody got a patent on the cure for, I don't know, HIV or some form of cancer and didn't do anything with it? It doesn't seem right that somebody could prevent anyone else in the world from using that invention of such value for humanity and then suffer the consequence of infringing if you went ahead and violated the patent.
Well, you know, Tom, I mean, you certainly draw an interesting point there, which is how does society balance the rights of inventors to be compensated, given incentive to invent, because we would all be poorer if these kinds of inventions weren't made, versus society's interest in making sure that products, especially cures for HIV or cures for cancer, are brought to them. And there was a Supreme Court case, eBay, the eBay company, about 3 or 4 years ago, that said there is no presumption that an injunction will be granted to the patent owner if he successfully sues someone, that instead a balancing test will be used, just like any other area of the law. And one of the four areas that's balanced is public policy. So it's always possible in those rare instances where you've got a cure for cancer or a cure for HIV that the judge might say there's a need for this cancer treatment because you're not making it available to the market. We are going to force you to license someone who is willing to. It's called a compulsory license. You, Mr. Patent Owner, will be compensated, but you're not going to be able to withhold this from the marketplace.
All right. So in that situation, such a phenomenal benefit or boon to everyone in the world really wouldn't be capable of being bottled up, but the inventor would become well compensated for the use of the product.
Well, that's right. And you know, I think maybe an example, a real-life example people might relate to was the BlackBerry case several years ago, where there was a valid patent, there was clear infringement, but all the BlackBerry owners said, well, gosh, we can't have our rights to use our BlackBerries taken away. In that case, the infringing party had to take a license for about $600 million, and that ultimately allowed people to keep their BlackBerries turned on.
All right, Dave Beek, great show, always fascinating. Mark these words, patent law in the spotlight again. Tom Schroyer, of course, our host. Tom, what's coming up next week?
Well, first of all, I won't be able to be here with you or the listener, Steve. I'll be subbed in for by Brian Grogan. And Brian will be joined by Jim Rubenstein, who was just on your program here this past week to talk about business bankruptcies.
All right, very good. That's next week, Minnesota Law, between noon and 1 o'clock. Presented by Moss and Barnett, available online at moss-barnett.com. Thanks so much for listening to the program. All the news and weather coming up next here on News Radio 830 WCCO.